Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podblog episodes related to theological semiotics.
Greetings, everyone. This is Terry Rankin, Deep Adaptation Guide and Administrator of the Philosophy Discussion Group and the Professions Network Group, et cetera, et cetera. And it is my honor to introduce you to my friend, Jonathan Esterman, used to be and is now is actually Rabbi Yoni Aryeh.
And Reb Yoni now. I'm working on getting my rabbinic certification, so it's a progress.
Okay.
I do function as a rabbi in many areas, but I'm still working on the actual degree part of it.
I see. All right. I said about to. Anyway, yes. All that to say, Yoni and I became fast friends during our doctoral ministry studies at Portland Seminary of George Fox University from 2015 to 2016.
August 2016, you posted those things on Facebook. I thought to myself, what in the world am I getting into?
Well, I want to tell the story of who the Jonathan Esterman I met was and who Yoni Aryeh became during that three-year season. But I'm going to leave that to you because I want you to tell it your way. So anyway, here we are. We're fast friends. We co-host a podcast, and I do the video side of it. I haven't really posted any of those yet, but it's called Semiobites, where he and I have regular discussions, probably 10 episodes a season, roughly.
About, yes.
Yeah, so we have these ongoing discussions about, quote, literally building bridges of shalom between Jews and Christians. I'm the Christian, he's the Jew, but he knows more about both of those than I do, which is kind of intimidating. He certainly knows more about the observant Orthodox Jewish way of life. And that's the, no pun intended, that's the hat I want you to wear while you're answering these questions, okay?
I put it on, so we're good.
There you go, all right. So we have basically three pretty complicated questions, and we're going to use them for two purposes. We're going to record an episode for our Semiobites podcast, and 30, 45 minutes long. And by the way, today is Friday the 8th of October, 2021, just so our listeners and viewers will know kind of what we're doing and where we are in time.
And for those who care about the real date, it's the 2nd of Cheshvan, 5782.
Got me. Okay. Outstanding. So we have one of the purposes is an episode for our Semiobites podcast and video series. The other is, in my role at Deep Adaptation, like I said, I work with several groups, and three groups have gotten together to look at the questions surrounding what Deep Adaptation takes to be this period of imminent and ongoing, actually, collapse of ecosystems, biosystems, ecospheres, biospheres, civilizations, institutions. It's happening all around us. So Deep Adaptation argues, and I fully agree. And so the business and finance group, this is an odd mix. I mean, this is really a motley crew. It's the business and finance group. It's the interfaith circle. And it's and I kind of represent the interfaith circle and the philosophy group. So it's all of those perspectives coming together to answer the kinds of questions that I'm going to be bringing before us here. So shall we begin with the first one?
Sounds great.
These are verbose, so bear with me. The first one reads, on a spectrum from staunch denial of impending collapse to mass extinction at one end, for example, by the Trump crowd, and on the other end, an all-in nonviolent activism or spiritual attunement, or both, like Roger Hallam and Jim Bendel. That's Extinction Rebellion and Deep Adaptation, for those who don't know. They're the founders of those two movements. Where would you place yourself, Yoni? And where does your local community of observant Orthodox Jews, and more generally within the broader Jewish communities of different types, without going too far into the distinctions between those types, where do you place yourself locally, and what's the general perspective or range of perspectives within the wider Jewish community?
There's this beautiful song out there. It's sung by this amazing group. Very, very observant, right? They're called Counting Crows. It's the end of the world as we know it, right? Okay. A very religious concept. Looking from an Orthodox lens, it is the end of the world because it's year 5,782 of creation. And we are given the task to warrant bringing about the redemption of the Garden of Eden before year 6,000. And if we earn it, then we get, there's two options for Messiah to come, Mashiach to come, which is found in our Talmud. It's not found in the Torah itself. Torah is absolutely void whatsoever of any references to a Messiah concept within Genesis through, I believe, the Christian order of things ends with Malachi. It's just not there. There's allusions, but there's nothing flat out that says it, right? And so the Talmud discusses it, and they go into it, and they say, well, there's going to be Mashiach, and there's two ways Mashiach can come. Mashiach can come in a peaceful way, which is we have ascended to the state of purity as a Jewish nation and as a world into which we have earned back Garden of Eden. Now, let's forget the fact that we had the flood, right? And everything else that's happened since then, including the destruction of the temple. It sounds nice. But when you conclude all, when you include all of history, and you say, if somebody does something and then they do it again, according to there's a halakha concept that they've made it like a habit for them, right? Halakha being a term for it, it's Jewish law. Humanity has made a habit of not living up to the standards of which were presented, which aren't that hard of standards. But humanity routinely fails at this. So it's unlikely that we're going to warrant a peaceful era with a Messiah in which everything's hunky-dory, wonderful. We have till year 6,000, right? We haven't done it in 5,782 years.
That's unlikely. That's just over two centuries on your own calendar, right? Remains.
It's, yeah. Yeah, it's 228 more years. Or 218 more years, sorry. 218 more years. Yeah. 218 more years to do what we haven't done in 5,782 years. I'm not going to bet on that, right?
So what's a bet either?
So the concepts of the Messiah of peace, that's out the window. So what's the alternative? A Messiah of war. And what is this Messiah of war? One that is ridding the impurity from us, is yanking it out forcibly, and bringing the world through a period of destruction in order to renew it. Because we have polluted the earth to such a means where we can't redeem it, Hashem is going to rebuild the monarchy, which our Messiah is not one that is of spiritual nature, but one that is of blood and flesh under the lineage of King David. And it will lead this process of renewal, not through peace, but through destruction and rebuilding. In which case, the world is coming to an end.
Okay. I'm. You explained it very clearly, and I must say I'm not surprised, but that's as clear as I've ever heard you take that position. I appreciate that. So Definitely. Personally, you feel the world, you does your observant community share that perspective, I assume?
I am the Haredi in my community. There's several of us, right? But I'm more Orthodox than a lot of people in the community. I'm in Portland, Oregon, right? It's a Portland community. If this community was anywhere else, we'd have titles within the religious circles. Here we just call it Portland because, well, that explains itself. But within Orthodoxy, there's lots of subgroups and everything. I stick to the more observant crowd and more, this is how I do things. After all, how I dress, how I live my life is all based off Torah. It's not, I don't do color. I don't go around and shop in the malls. I don't watch shows. I don't go to things, right? Not in the same way that everybody else goes to things. So I'm part of the more Orthodox crowd. I think most Orthodox Jews who look at it from a Torah lens would say, yeah, this is how it is. And so as a result, not all of them are focused on sustainability, environmentalism, because what's the point if it's all going to be destroyed anyways?
In just 2 centuries, yeah.
Yeah, this is where I differ a little bit. And I'm like, I get what you're saying, but we have the concept, if not who, then, if not me, then who, and if not now, then when, and that just because I'm not obligated to finish the work, says Perkiavos, it doesn't mean I'm not obligated to do what I can when I can.
Right, right, right. You've mentioned that before in our other discussions, and I've always appreciated it. You didn't really go into the wider, across that spectrum of perspectives. I mean, I see that you're really close to that end, if not actually at that end of, it's the end of the world as we know it. But because it's simply the right thing to do, to put it differently, we must do the best we can, even though it's an exercise, if you will, in futility.
Yes.
We're facing a Messiah, the Jewish term for Yeshua, right? We're facing that warrior as opposed to that bringer of peace.
Yes.
Okay. Is that a minority, a plurality, or a majority view among observant Orthodox Jews?
Oh, you're putting me in a minefield here, man. You use the terms observant Orthodox Jews. It implies if I say anybody disagrees with what I said that they're not observant or they're not Orthodox.
I'm sorry, I did not mean to do that.
No, I'm just saying it's complicated, right?
Okay.
We live in this, we have this thing called Galus. Galus is, it's what we are today. It is exile and it is despair. We're waiting to be restored to our land. We're waiting to be restored. It's because how Jewish law applies in America in particular is so different than how it applies in its Israel, because people here, it's very easy to assimilate. And so we have to judge them more favorably. Whereas the non-observant Jew in the wrong neighborhood in Eretz Israel can be in a lot of hot water. Here, like, he doesn't know any better. So
I see. So culture,
that's the challenge
into play that change it.
Yes.
In different cultural settings, from local to global.
Yeah. So part. For example, this morning I was learning regarding prohibited meat, right? So meats that's been cut correctly, it's kosher animal, it's kosher cut. And it's time to remove the blood, right? There's discussion on how to do it. And so we say we have to do Hadaka Rishona, which is an initial washing. I don't want to get into the there's a lot of ideas. It could be a rinsing, it could be a scrubbing, it could be a soaking. And then there's a salting. And then there's a machlokus, which is a disagreement. What if you forgot to wash it before you salted it? So most people say, go wash it and then salt it again. There's one person that says, actually, no. Because the act of salting it took the blood on the outside and shoved it inside. You can't get it back out. So it's forbidden forever.
So it's...
He's a minority opinion. But his minority opinion saying you could be over a Torah level prohibition. So we take that into concern. And we say, okay, according to the smock, we can't do this. We have to wash before we rinse. However, in a case of need, such as Shabbos is about to start, or we have guests coming over, and this is the only meat, or it could cost a business thousands of dollars, we have what to rely on that we could just rinse it again. It's not ideal. It's not the right way, but we allow it in case of need. Mm-hmm. In the same way, here in America, in case of need, where most Jews grew up assimilated, and it's very easy to fit into American culture, we have to be more lenient with them, and we have to allow things that normally we would not allow according to the letter of the law, but we permit according to the intent of the law.
I see. Okay. All right. Let's move on. I think you've already answered most of this next question. How widely do the projected timelines vary among the it's true and real collapse aware members of those groups? You've already said those who buy into that will acknowledge that it's somewhere around 220 years.
Yeah, but not everybody buys into it, right?
Yeah.
That's a challenge, right? And so not everybody buys into it. Some people, that's literal, it's more metaphoric. I personally don't see where the argument's coming from. That's not relevant. There's also the non-Orthodox groups that they don't buy into this messianic era, and they don't buy into rebuilding the temple. And they think that we need to fix the world because it's all it's got, and once it's done, it's done.
Yeah. Is there more to that question? Oh, no, that's the 218 years is a very clear answer to that second question. So let's move on to the third one. In terms of the law and the prophets, okay, and I'm just kind of assuming that I can put us on the same page with that phrase. What does an economy look like under the law and the prophets? And whatever it is, what kinds of medium or media of exchange would be in keeping with the virtues, the values, the principles, practices, etc., of observance under that law and those prophets? How must human economy serve God and human under those teachings?
So, all right,
Economy,
let's delve into this.
purely,
Yeah.
what's an economy look like?
Purely economy, business ethics, these types of things. We have an entire category of Jewish law for this called Chosen Mishpat, right? Business ethics, more or less.
Kosher
And we have
mishpat?
this
That was kosher
Koshen
mishpat?
Mishpat.
Okay.
Koshen Mishpat, business
Kosher.
ethics, right?
That's
We
fine.
study this. How do we have to behave as a Jew owning a business or shopping from a business? How do we behave with other Jews? How do we behave with non-Jews? What do we do in all these different types of situations? When is interest permitted? When is interest prohibited? What type of sustainability initiatives do we need to do? Am I allowed to learn Torah on a lunch break? Am I allowed to learn Torah if I'm working in a bookstore and there's no customers coming in? Or is that stealing time from my employer? We have a lot that goes into the technicalities of this. We have entire studies and entire ways of learning dedicated to refining our knowledge of this, right? And so there's a lot that Judaism has to say on this, just as a result of that. Okay.
Yeah.
There's a difference. I think there's a difference in your question here.
Okay.
Are you asking for here and now? Are you asking for end of the world itis?
Well, the thoughtful answer for me would be it's kind of both. Because if, as you were saying earlier, as an observant Jew, you're obligated to do the right thing, even if it's futile. So that
Yes.
would kind of imply that you need to do what it's going to be, what should be, you should be doing now.
Which we do.
Okay, and then after the collapse, as it were, after the return of the warrior or the priest, peace bringer, that's when the fulfillment of that ideal would be built up from the ashes, right? Like a phoenix
It'll be
rising from
different.
the ashes. Well, of course, it would be
Funny,
certain.
funny usage there. Funny. I want to dive into the Phoenix in a moment, but fun.
Okay.
Okay, so first off, the world that we are going to be having under a messianic era is different than the world today, right? We're in what's called the B'dyavad situation. It's not the ideal situation. We're in exile. We're in a world that does not follow Torah. It does not believe in Hashem. This is not ideal. This is not what was made to be. Okay.
Yes.
So we're doing the best we can with the tools we have. We found laws to make it work in our B'dyavad situation. Just like the Jew that grows up in America not knowing they're a Jew, we find leniencies to allow them to connect, right? Judaism's not meant to be impossible, it's meant to be doable. Okay. So we have to find what we can work with. That's different than what will be, because what will be is the ideal situation. All the Jews will live in Israel. Everyone, the whole world will know that God is king. And everyone will serve God. Much different scenario, right? We're trying to go back to this concept of Garden of Eden in some ways too. We want simpler ways. We want to restore relationship and not be separated. So things are going to be quite different. Okay. Some things will still apply, of course. We'll still have laws on how businesses work. But the businesses that are supposed to work at the end is different than now. And there's this weird, funky period because we have this concept that we never fully die, like our bodies. Though those may return to dust, but our neshama, our soul, that's part of God. And so that can't expire. It can't come to an end of existence. And it has to be returned to that holiness. And so what does that look like? And that's where we come up with the discussions that we say within Torah about the resurrection of the dead.
Well, you and I have had a conversation in one of the earlier episodes about the paths through death
Yes.
and back.
Yes. But then that's the and back part when everyone's resurrected. That
it.
we haven't dived as much into, but the economy then is going to be different, very different than the economy now.
So it's
The
a
economy
whole.
now is we have these laws that we follow. For example, I can't charge a Jew interest. If I loan Levy down the street $25 and he comes back and says, thank you for loaning $25, here's $30, I have to say no. loan was $25. If it was $24.99 and he offers me $25, it's like, no, loan is $24.99. Oh, well, you know, I only pay in whole numbers. This happened to me, right? Somebody overpaid me for a product that I had listed at a set price. I say, you overpaid me by 12 cents. I said, oh, well, I only pay in whole numbers. I don't do cents. I was like, well, I can't accept 12 cents. I can either A, return it to you, or B, you tell me that you wanted me to donate that 12 cents to the Zaka charity, and I'll go give it to somebody. And so he's like, okay, go do the charity for 12 cents. Right? I can't charge you interest. It's just how it is. Right? It's a law. There's no way around it. Now, we have similar concepts. Right now, we're in Yerkol Shemitah a year, right? Every 7 years, we have to give the land, or every six, there's 6 years of labor and 1 year of rest for the land. We entered Shemitah a year with this Rosh Hashanah. The land in Eretz Yisrael is Shemitah produce right now. We cannot do regular agricultural business with it. There are workarounds in which we can still survive, but it's not a regular business year. And so we follow those laws. Now, that's the observant Jews. Not a non-observant Jews, I can't tell you if they're following laws or not. Israel's a very weird country right now. Like, they're how they have things working, it's very, very weird. And that's not ideal. But for those who are following the laws, they're following the laws, right? And so we have these laws that do apply that we have to apply.
Okay.
The economy for later is different.
Okay. You said you wanted to talk about the Phoenix. So let's move to
yes.
that
topic. Okay, so this week that we're recording the episode is Parasha Noach. Every week we do a section of the Torah so that by the end of the year we finish the whole Torah. So we just restarted, right? So Parashas Noach, which starts with the story of Noach, okay? The Gemara, the Talmud, talks about how Noah had to go and feed all the animals. And he had to know what they needed and how to feed them, right? And after feeding all these animals and dealing with all these different animals, he eventually comes across the room. He looks in and he's like, oh my gosh, there's a bird in here. He goes in there and he's like, what are you doing in here? I didn't know you're in here. I haven't fed you. And he was like, yeah, I know. He's like, why didn't you say something? Well, you were busy feeding the other animals. I've got no problem waiting. Noah looks at him and says, you will live a long life. They discuss, oh, Noah has the ability to give blessings? No, he doesn't. He's saying, with that type of character, you're bound to live a long life. Turns out this bird is known for living for 1,000 years. At 1,000 years, its body disintegrates into ash, and then it comes back.
That's
like a phoenix.
I see. Cool. Cool story. I have to say two more things, and then we'll pretty much close it. I think we're about 30 plus minutes in, I believe, which is about good. So you didn't tell the story that I opened with, who you were in the middle of 2016 and who you became by the middle of 2017.
Ah, yes. So living in Gresham, I was a Messianic Christian. So I was, my father was Jewish, my mother wasn't. So I was doing things to the best I knew based off Google searches and having no community whatsoever. I decided my master's degree. I want to get a bachelor's. I always wanted to go to George Fox. It was like a life dream. Turns out they have an online program I can do. I go meet the staff there and we're talking and they're really fascinated. And I'm interested in this one program that I want to apply for. And the assistant director, he says to me during the interview, like, you know, I want you to think about a different program. Like, well, what do you mean? It's like, I want to do spiritual formations. It's like, why don't you think about learning about semiotics? What do you think about that? I'm like, I know semiotics. I did some of it during my associate's degree. Okay. All right. Fine. Whatever. Well, it's led by Len Sweet. Do you know who he is? Oh, yeah, I know about Len Sweet. I used to write book reviews about his stuff. Oh, okay. All right. I go home. Wife about it. I was like, oh, well, you know, you guys do that. I was like, so I thought more about it. And I was like, all right, you know, that's what I'll do. It's going to carry more credibility. Len Sweet, like, which to me was big news because, like, lots of books, right? And more credibility. my neighbor, two door down, he's a bishop. He knows who Len Sweet is. He listens to our podcast because we had Len Sweet on. He's like, wait, you know him? I was like, yeah. he taught me. So I start this program, right? I'm like, oh, I'm thinking, what do I want to do? All right, you know, Judaism and Christianity, it's always been a muddled up mess. I'll work on Jewish-Christian relations. And so that'll be my dissertation focus. And so the first term, I did what I've been avoiding all my life. I decided to learn about my family's heritage, which includes the Holocaust. And I started learning about Jewish-Christian relations throughout history. I got really upset by it. And it was hard to process. Like, there's just a lot of pain that didn't need to exist, a lot of hurt that didn't need to exist. And so I wrote about it in my first term paper. And my advisor comes back and says, that's great. Now you need to do the next step, and you need to get to know the local Jewish community, because how can you ever accurately work on Jewish-Christian relations without knowing actual Jews on the ground?
Can you tell me who your advisor was that gave you that wonderful advice?
Yeah, Dr. Douglas Balzer.
Oh, Balzer, okay. Smart guy.
Yes. So I reach out to, well, it wasn't so much reach out, it was like, it was Hishkaka Pratis, which means divine encounter, right? It was from God, not me, divine providence. I'm talking to my wife, I'm working, we're texting, like, I don't know what to do about this, how do we connect with the community and everything. I get this Facebook invite. It turns out I'm Facebook friends with a rabbi in the community. I don't know how this happens. We've been Facebook friends for like 2 years now. I've never actually met him. And he invited me to this 10-week series, a 10-week series called Masorah, which is learn the fundamentals of Judaism if you weren't born with it. Like, oh. It was like, but that price. It was like, oh, don't worry. If you come with your wife, we'll give you 70% off. Oh. Well, when is it? First class is tonight. Oh. Can we bring our kids? No. We've never used daycare or babysitting ever in our life. What do we do? Turns out, my wife had his cousin that lived just a few miles away from the community who just moved over here by happenstance, who was available to watch our kids that night and for all the classes for the 10 weeks.
Wow.
Afterwards,
how those coincidences just kind of stack up, isn't it?
I know, right? Afterwards, he moved on. But during, so we go to the first class. Like, the first class was very, it rocked me to the core. As a Christian, you're taught that the only true love is that of Yeshka, right? And that those who don't have him don't know true love, and they don't know true passion. And watching this rabbi talk about what it means to love God, it challenged everything. Whoa. Okay. Next week we go, and the dean of the organization is there. Hey, I heard you're from Gresham. Yeah. There's Jews there? No, not really. Are you Jews for Jay? No, we don't support what they do. We don't agree with what they do. Oh, but you believe that you need Yeshka to be saved? Yeah. Okay, we need to talk. Let's schedule a meeting. So schedule a meeting. Says, it's good I found you. Our community recently had undercover missionaries. It really hurt the community. So a lot of people are very gun shy. And we need to have some ground rules. I'm a gatekeeper for this community, and here's the rules for you to participate in anything.
Right, you're talking about the infamous Jews for Jesus movement.
Yes,
right?
The beliefs that they should convert Jews. It's horrible. Anyways, so we would go over the ground rules. The ground rules is you can go to this class, and that's it. And then you can go away. We don't need anybody here that believes in Yeshka. It's just not welcome.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. And I said, okay. He's like, but are you interested in learning more and trying to like see if what you believe is real? And I looked up and said, well, if we prove our right, would you be willing to hear that? And he said, yes. And so he gave us a list of books to take a look at. And we're like, okay, we're going to compare this with our books and look at this. And he explained, I want to cover something. These different prophecies that Yeshka is supposed to fulfill, right? Go look at the parking lot. Go look at the parking lot. I was like, he looks at me and says, this is Rabbi Fisher. Look, Rabbi Fisher says, I'm prophesying that parking lot's full. Parking lot's empty. Well, no, it's empty. That's not a prophecy. He's like, no, it will be full one day. I'll be right eventually. So that was like his little jab. But so we spent a few weeks, and we decided, you know what, we're gonna give this the attention it deserves. We are convinced, oh, we can get the head of this organization, a rabbi, right? We can get him over. So we research it. And our approach is this, is to build a case that is beyond reasonable doubt.
Now, this based is on your, Jewish this sources. Is your wife, Tasha, right?
And yes, we had the, we decided, community? Like, not using that community, just us and the resources I had with the cohort. Right, to build a case beyond reasonable doubt, to present using only Jewish sources that proves Yeshua to be Messiah,
okay.
Which involved us delving into the Jewish sources and delving into the Hebrew, and then finding out that there's translation issues when you come to English and Latin and Greek that don't work. And the more we found, the more consistencies and struggles and the lack of Torah transmission to the New Testament, and the more that Christianity matched nothing like what was supposed to be, the more we came to an issue. And it came to the point of, there's no beyond reasonable doubt that this is correct. In fact, I have all sorts of doubt. And that's a problem. If Judaism came before Christianity, and all I can do is prove that Christianity has no root in Judaism, but it says it comes from Judaism, that's a problem. I can't subscribe to that.
Yeah.
And so we made the decision that we were wrong. And that Christianity was wrong. And that there's no possible way for it to work. And so we made the move into the community and started the conversion process. And we eventually finished that long conversion process. And Now I do kosher. I do all sorts of mitzvah related stuff. I'm working on becoming a rabbi, and that's where we are.
I know. I've told you this before, Yoni, but having kind of been close to you through that journey, virtually mostly, but having been close to you through that journey, I am literally astonished at how completely, and how effectively, how deeply, and how rapidly you've made that transmission. I mean, the man I'm looking at right now is a complete remodel, a complete do-over, if you will, of an identity that was into the identity that sits before me now. And I mean, it has a presence that seems a natural fit for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say that was true before we got to here. I mean, I loved you then when I kind of danced around you the first time we were together physically, because you and I kind of had a curiosity about one another, I think. And we kind of danced around that for a day or two, and then we realized, oh, wait a minute, we can make this work. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks for sharing that historical background. That really gave me even better insight into that journey. Last question. This has to do with the bridges of shalom that we focus on in our podcast. And you've pointed out to me that there is a fairly solid common ground between Jews and Christians that the Jews acknowledge, which is the Noahide laws, right? And the Jews acknowledge this and welcome Christians who will at least step up to that law, those laws, right? The vast majority of what we learned under Dr. Sweet of the attractional propositional colonialist Western church, right, would just kind of, no, you know, that's the, they would just, you know, throw mud all over that. And I'm being polite when I use the word mud. So just enlighten us a little bit on what that bridge looks like for the benefit. I mean, I kind of have a feel for it, but it always helps me to hear it again.
Yeah. So the Noahide laws, they're the laws given to Noah after the flood. There's only seven of them, right? Today, we hold, there's more than seven, right? But there's seven categories, okay? And it's because these laws are very generic. They're considered of laws, which is the head of the category. And the way it is so generic, there has to be detailing, well, what does this mean? Okay? And that's pretty easy. Known appropriate relationships, right? Have a system of courts. Those types of things. Very simple. In fact, Christians naturally fulfill most of them. There is a disagreement on one of them. Believe in one God.
Yeah, that's the Trinity question, right?
There's the Trinity question. And then one of the subcategories of that is Yeshka an issue or not? And you have a disagreement within the community, and some hold that that's not an issue, because if they say Yeshka is the only God, then they may be believing in the wrong God, but they met the technicality of believing in one God. So there's some say it's fine, some say it's not fine. But generally speaking, today, like I said, we're in a vidyavid situation. It's generally accepted that's fine. If you can do moral life and clarify that the Trinity does not mean three gods, but you're just trying to view God in three different lenses, because we do that all the time. God has 13 attributes, 13 ways he expresses himself. And then don't try to convert us. It's that simple.
Okay, very good. That pretty well wraps it up, Yoni. So I think we have a great episode for the podcast, Semiobites. And for those of you who are interested, if you just Google Semiobites, you'll find our podcast.
So yes, you can even go to
Go ahead.
Semiobites.com.
Semiobites.com, right. Yoni hosts that through his own very robust website that has several blogs on it and lots of writings of yours and other people. It's a really good website for both Christians and Jews. I had a thought that I wanted to close with, but I don't think it matters. I think this will be useful for that event that's coming up on the 20th of October. And I will... Anyone who wants to know about that event, which is open to the public, Deep Adaptation is hosting it, but it's going to be a discussion around the question I asked Yoni about the business model, for lack of a better phrase, the economic frame of business, philosophy, faith, and how that all kind of those dynamics work together. I know what my closing thought was. I am a dissident Christian. You know this. And it goes to what I learned from Lynn. I remain...
We're working on bringing you all the way, you know.
We'll come to that in our next episode. But be that as it may, I must say, the fruit of this relationship for me has been a just accelerating, deepening understanding of the semiotic dynamics at work. Between us, just between us and our podcasts and things. And of course, that reverberates out into my whole life, and it reverberates out into yours as well. And it's, you know me, it's all about the resonant harmonies, you know. You know something? It dawned on me one day recently that I had been focused entirely on Lynn's presentation of resonant harmony of differences. Well, similarities are resonant harmonies just as well. And I hadn't even been thinking down that whole road of all of this until probably a month or two ago.
So here's something to consider with that. A resonant harmony of differences. You and I can sing at two different levels, tones, and it sound good together.
Yeah.
Similar. If we sound very similar to each other, but we're just slightly off, it hurts the ears.
Exactly. That's why I always use the musical metaphor. The triads in music, those three tones that make the chord. There's your triad. Three tones that make the chord. C, E, and G is a C major. One of them by themselves is just a monotone, boring, nothing. Even when you get two of them together, any two of those three, now you have what's called a power chord, right? It's like the root and the fifth or something, I'm not sure. But when you get all three of them, now you've got the full, robust range of the tones that make the triad a whole. Anyway, beautiful musical metaphor, wonderful conversation yet again, Yoni. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Give my best to Tasha and the kids, the boys.
Well done.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobites@gmail.com. SemioBytes is a podcast co-hosted by Yidbrick and Semio City that answers Semitic questions via Semiotic analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. SemioBytes is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankin.